biography.
Thank you. I'm not going to talk about dualities, but you guys can. I changed my talk at the last minute. Thanks to the organizers for this kind of invitation to share some very recent work, which is actually some of the first work from my lab at UCSB. So I'm going to start with a little brief introduction to at least the experimental perspective on half-filled Landau levels in especially gallium arsenide, and then I'll tell you about what's unique and in particular what's not unique about bilayer graphene, share some developments in terms of measurement technique that we've made as well as in terms of sample quality, and then tell you what we've learned in the last month or two about fractional quantum Hall effect, specifically the fractional quantum Hall effect and other competing phases at nu equals a half in bilayer graphene. So, I don't think I need to explain any of this to any of you, but my sort of very naive picture about what happens at half filling is that you can make this composite fermion ansatz, and you can say that all the electrons bind to flux quanta, and that may or may not be right in the sense that it may or may not give you a relatively weakly interacting theory, but it seems to work okay because there have been Fermi surfaces that have been observed at, for example, the n equals 0 Landau level, and in many ways you can think about the half-filled Landau level somehow in terms of composite fermions, which suggests that in fact it's not a bad place to start. But the residual interactions between those composite fermions, if you want to talk about it that way, can give you things that are not a Fermi liquid, so most famously this paired state, Pfaffian state, that sort of maps to a superconductor or charge density wave states or who knows what else. And that's somewhat the point of view that I'll use throughout this talk. So for example, in gallium arsenide, long ago, it was predicted that there should be a Fermi surface of these composite fermions at nu equals a half, and indeed surface acoustic wave measurements as well as mesoscopic transport measurements saw signatures of a Fermi surface in the zeroth, the n equals zero or Landau level. And gallium arsenide, which is rather, beautiful. You don't have a Fermi surface, and then you turn on a magnetic field, and you go to exactly a half, and that's where the effective magnetic field of the composite fermions vanishes, and you have a Fermi surface again. Of course, in other Landau levels, that's not the case. So, for example, in all the higher Landau levels, n equals 2, n equals 3, n equals 4, you don't have a Fermi surface. Rather, you have some type of charge density wave order, which is anisotropic, so people measure transport in different directions in the same sample, and they find that the resistance is very different from one to the other. But maybe the most, at least, some of the most interesting phenomena happen either in the n equals 1 Landau level or in multi-component systems where a quantized Hall plateau is observed at half filling. And that can be thought about as essentially a superconductor of these composite fermions. And moreover, was long ago predicted by Moore and Reed and followed up many times since, to host essentially the lowest energy excitation should be non-abelian quasiparticles. Of course, despite intense effort, the efforts to really pin down this Pfaffian phase have been sort of a mixed track record. So numerics suggest very strongly that, in fact, in a single component, n equals 1 Landau level, the Pfaffian should be the ground state. There's good overlap with that wave function. And experiments, for example, show that in gallium arsenide under certain conditions, in fact, the wave function is single component. It's fully spin polarized, so that's a good sign. You can measure the kind of elementary charge, and you find E over 4, which is, again, consistent with the Pfaffian, but it's also consistent with any other quantized fractional quantum Hall state at half filling. But the smoking gun experiments where you would be able to, for example, do interferometry of E over 4 quasiparticles in the Pfaffian have not really worked. And this is presumably due to two things. One is that there are lots of proximal phases, and in fact, that's sort of an interesting direction. Recently, for example, even under isotropic pressure, you can tune from this Pfaffian to some kind of anisotropic charge density wave state. So it's not clear, for example, when you confine things to a quantum dot, whether this type of physics could be a problem. But maybe more importantly, the energy scales are just very small that characterize the Pfaffian. So all of the thermally activated energy gaps that have ever been measured have been well below a Kelvin. The largest is about 0.55 Kelvin in gallium arsenide. and never much higher than that. So that's generally measured in pristine two-dimensional electron gases without any gates of any kind, without any additional processing. And any time you do additional processing, that seems to degrade things, at least in the semiconductor setting. So that's where we start. And that's really, I think, what stood in the way of, for example, definitively proving that, in fact, there are non-abelian statistics of these quasiparticles, which would obviously be a very beautiful experimental demonstration, not to mention that, you know, the optimistic among us might want to use that for topological quantum computation. So that's the background. So let me tell you a little bit about the system that we're studying. So I'm going to tell you about experiments on Bernal stacked bilayer graphene. So the bilayer graphene looks like this. There's two monolayers, one on top of the other, in which one of the atoms in the unit cell of the top layer sits right on top of one of the atoms in the unit cell of the bottom layer, but the other atoms sit on top of the centers of these hexagons. So there's a strong interlayer tunneling between these two lattice sites, but not, of course, between the others. And you can write the low energy effective theory, and it just looks like a this sort of 2x2 Hamiltonian, a single valley, that ultimately gives you quadratic dispersions when you don't have some applied electric field. I'm interested in what happens at high magnetic field, and in fact, in bilayer graphene, the zero energy lambda level, so-called, is rather interesting, because, of course, this is the Hamiltonian in a single valley, so when you quantize it, you end up with a lambda level spectrum, but because of this 2x2 quadratic nature, you end up with a accidental degeneracy between the n equals 0 and n equals 1 orbital states. Of course, you also have valley degeneracy and you also have spin degeneracy. So starting off, it seems like you have essentially an eightfold degenerate zero energy lambda level. And the wave functions, for example, you know, one of the characteristics of these honeycomb systems is that the wave functions of these zero modes are fully polarized on one or the other of the sublattices. And in bilayer graphene, that actually means one or the other of the layers, because the relevant sublattices sit on different layers. So of course, you know, back in 2006, Novoselov and Geim published the first paper on bilayer graphene quantum Hall effect, and indeed they saw that the lowest lambda level seemed to span eightfold degeneracy. So this is in units of 4e squared over h, and you see a Hall plateau at 4e squared over h and minus 4e squared over h, consistent with this eightfold degeneracy. But of course, there's no such thing as a real degeneracy, and in fact, as samples got cleaner, there started to be reports of, for example, well, this is measurements of compressibility, but there were gaps not only at nu equals plus and minus 4, but also nu equals plus and minus 2, and nu equals 0, and eventually nu equals any integer. Right, so there's not any real degeneracy. So of relevance to us are what are the different anisotropies within the system. And it turns out there are sort of two flavors of anisotropy. There are single particle effects, so obviously the Zeeman effect, you're in a large magnetic field, spin degeneracy is not really a degeneracy. You can split the valleys with an electric field. So an electric field applied perpendicular to the plane, of course, puts a different potential on the sublattices in the top and bottom layer. That splits your valleys. There's also an electron hole asymmetry in the single particle band structure, which is essentially universally ignored in both the theoretical and experimental literature, but is not small. So that actually lifts the degeneracy of the 0 and 1 orbital states. Not surprising, that was not there's no symmetry that protects that even approximately, so it's really just an accidental degeneracy. So at the single particle level, you already have all degeneracies lifted, but as it turns out, you know, many body effects also will compete to lift degeneracies, and they're also quite strong. So most notably, the n equals 0 and n equals 1 wave functions have very different exchange, and so you would like to fill the n equals 0 states first, and in particular, once you've filled an n equals 0 state, it's very favorable to fill an n equals 1 state of the same spin and valley. That's going to save you a lot of Coulomb energy, and that's an energy that's going to be about the bare Coulomb scale of order. There's also anisotropies coming from short-range interactions within this spin and valley isospin, if you want to think about it that way. Those become stronger in certain regimes and not in others. I won't discuss them too much today. So certainly, especially recent experiments, have seen the full lifting of all of these degeneracies in the sense that Hall plateaus are observed at every integer filling within the zero energy lambda level. But that And there's certainly a conventional wisdom as to how that happens based on what I just told you, effectively, that you'd like to you'll choose some isospin direction within the spin and valley, kind of approximately SU4 symmetric isospin. You'll fill a zero state, and then you should fill a one state, because that saves you exchange energy. Which direction within SU4 you choose depends on these other anisotropies, and so on and so forth. And then you can think about essentially having quantum Hall ferromagnets of these orbital doublets. So that's the conventional wisdom. It's not entirely clear that it's consistent with these experimental measurements. So here you can see that, for example, there are states that would appear naively to be orbitally polarized. It's not clear why that would happen. But there's a fundamental issue experimentally that measuring the existence of a Hall plateau is not the same as measuring the order that you actually get. And there's a good, in fact, in the context of the half-filled lambda level, there's a very good historical example of how this can get you in trouble with the first measurements of the nu equals 5 halves quantum Hall effect in a tilted field showed that it collapsed, and therefore the immediate conclusion was it's not spin polarized. Long afterwards, that turned out to be wrong. This was an effect of, or the conclusion was wrong. The experiment, of course, was right. It turned out to be an effect of orbital squeezing due to the finite width of the well. And only later, when direct measurements of the spin polarization using NMR were performed, was it really clear that, in fact, this was fully spin polarized, as you would hope, and as, for example, would support a Pfaffian wave function. So direct experimental probes of order are quite important, and that's actually the main point of what I'm going to tell you today. So the experiment that that we're going to use is capacitance. So we're going to measure capacitance between gates on top and bottom of our bilayer and the graphene itself, or between the gates, one gate and the other. So in a two-dimensional electron gas, this is a pretty familiar experiment. Anytime you measure a gate capacitance, you have a contribution of quantum capacitance. It costs you energy not just to charge a classical capacitor, but you also have to move the Fermi energy, and so that costs you energy. It's proportional to the density of states. And so anytime you measure, for example, the top gate capacitance, the capacitance between the top gate and the two-dimensional electron gas, you're going to get some contribution due to density of states. But no matter what capacitance you measure, the density of states is kind of the only quantity you can be sensitive to. There's nothing else going on. So in a bilayer, that's not exactly true, because now charge can, you don't just, you, there's more than one way to move charge around within the bilayer. You could move it in from a contact, but you can also move it between layers. And in fact, the layers are an electrochemical equilibrium. They're not an electrical equilibrium, or the electrical potential is not the same on both layers. Rather, it's the electrochemical potential, which means that they can have different electrical potentials and different chemical potentials. And what this boils down to is that if you measure, for example, the top gate capacitance or the bottom gate capacitance, they don't probe the same physical quantity. For example, if charge is on the top layer, you will notice that more in the top gate capacitance than in the bottom gate capacitance, and so on and so forth. So just to get our notation straight, I'm going to talk about gate voltages in a kind of rotated basis, where I'm going to talk about N naught as being this symmetric combination of a top gate and bottom gate voltage. That's essentially what would give you charge density, right? So if this were just a strip of metal, N naught would be the charge density of that metal. P naught is the antisymmetric combination, and that's the electric field that wants to polarize the bilayer. So again, if it were a thin strip of metal, that would tell you the charge density difference between the top and bottom surfaces. But of course, due to band structure of the bilayer, due to electron interaction effects, the physically realized density and the physically realized layer polarization are not exactly N naught and P naught. Otherwise, this would be a very boring problem. All of the physics is going to be captured by the relationship between, for example, the physically realized charge density and the charge density you would get if this were just a metal. And it turns out that you can measure all of the derivatives of N and P with respect to N naught and P naught just by doing very careful capacitance measurements. I'll emphasize this is not terribly easy, because ultimately what you're trying to do is measure a very large capacitor, 3 angstroms thick, in parallel with a capacitor that's 100 nanometers thick. Sorry, in series with a capacitor that's 100 nanometers thick. And it's a relatively small correction, so you have to be careful about a lot of experimental details to do this. But the fact remains that, for example, if you measure the symmetric capacitance, which is defined as just the sum of the top and bottom gate capacitance, you'll effectively be probing the density of states. But if you measure the antisymmetric capacitance, meaning the difference between top and bottom gate capacitance, you'll see something that it turns out you can relate to the derivative of the polarization in the bilayer with respect to the electric field that normally gives you a density. Right? So it's pretty close to being the derivative of the polarization with respect to the density. In other words, if I add a charge, do I add it to the top layer or the bottom layer? And in the quantum Hall regime, do I add it to the to one valley or another valley? So you get a very direct measurement of the polarization. And you can do a similar measurement for the change in the polarization with respect to the polarizing field, in other words, the susceptibility of the system to polarization. So let me first tell you about one round of measurements performed in devices where the gates are both made of metal. To do these experiments, we use a kind of cryogenic amplifier setup. I'm happy to share the details if anybody's interested afterwards. So contrast is a little washed out, but in short, at very high magnetic fields, we see all of these degeneracies fully lifted. And when we measure, for example, the symmetric capacitance, so that's basically density of states, you see that there's eight incompressible states. There are transitions between them. I apologize for the contrast. It'll be much clearer in a couple of slides. And lots of transitions in between them. But we're in the same position as every other experiment that's either done transport or some kind of density of states probe. We don't really know what these states are, right? We can guess, we can listen to theorists, but it's not really the same as being able to measure directly. But if we measure C antisymmetric, then we get a much richer phase diagram. In particular, there's a lot of contrast, and there's contrast throughout partially filled Landau levels. So this x-axis, again, is effectively the density, and the y-axis is the polarizing field. So we're polarizing the bilayer. And we see that there are regions of the phase diagram that are red, and there are regions that are blue. So that we can pretty easily interpret. Red means that we are adding the marginal electron that goes onto the bilayer as we add density goes onto the top layer. Blue means it goes onto the bottom layer. There's also there's sort of this four-tone contrast where there are dark red regions and then there are orange regions, or there are dark blue regions and there are cyan regions. It's not so clear, it's not obvious at least, what that means. So it turns out to understand that you have to dig a little deeper into kind of the single particle physics of bilayer graphene, because it turns out that at high magnetic fields, that n equals one orbital has a little bit of support on some of these high energy sublattices, just enough that we can detect it. So in other words, even though the single particle eigenstates for the real zero energy state, which is the zero orbital, is purely sublattice polarized, but in the n equals one orbital, it's not purely sublattice polarized. It's got a little bit of zero character on some of these other sublattices, in particular on the other layer. And if you do the calculation at very high fields, the layer polarization of this n equals one state is not that big. Instead of being 100%, it's something like 60%. So that allows us actually to really simply interpret this phase diagram, because it basically means that where we see dark red, we're adding electrons to the n equals zero state on the top layer. Where we see dark blue, we're adding them to the n equals one state on the bottom, n equals zero state on the bottom layer, and orange and cyan correspond to the n equals one states. So if you just kind of count across, remember this is the derivative with respect to the x-axis, then you can essentially count how you've added electrons to the bilayer. So for example, down at the bottom, you add a 0 and then a 1 and then a 0 and then a 1 in the bottom layer. And that's actually exactly what you'd expect from sort of a Coulomb interaction-driven argument, because once you add a 0 to one spin and valley, you'll add the 1 to that spin and valley next, and then you'll populate a new spin and valley and so on. But there are regions where, for example, that's not true. So close to 0 electric field perpendicular to the layers, you add a 0 and then another 0. That's not consistent with what you would expect from Coulomb interaction. So I'm going to go into the guts of how we can model this and how we can understand this. For those of you who don't care about those details, let me just give you the punchline, which is that I think there's a general impression, especially in certain parts of the theoretical community, that monolayer graphene or bilayer graphene is somehow very complicated, that you have eightfold degeneracy and you have to think about very complicated multi-component wave functions in order to understand anything that's going on. The basic gist of the analysis of this data is that most of the time that's not true, because most of the time there's only one component that's really relevant to the low energy physics. You fill one shell and then you fill another shell, and so you can think about, for example, partial filling of an n equals zero state up here, and you can essentially ignore most of the other components to first order. Then you can worry about mixing and so on, but that's That's relatively important because, as I'm going to show you later, it means you can map a lot of your intuition about, say, normal conventional Landau level systems onto bilayer graphene, with the exception of some very interesting regions which then we can isolate and try to study. But let me tell you anyway how this all works out. So the way we've thought about this, and with Mike Zalatel helped a great deal in put together this model, is that, you know, when you start with the empty level, so imagine you have a fully empty n equals zero Landau level, well, you have some single particle energy spectrum. You know that there's no degeneracy because you have a Zeeman effect, you have some electric field that splits the valleys, and you have some orbital splitting that comes from just band structure. Nothing too interesting, but it gives you different energy levels. So first you have to fill the lowest energy level, depending on whatever electric field you're at. So let's say you're at the electric field corresponding to this yellow line. This is electric field, or the effective valley splitting really generated by the electric field, and this is your single particle energies. Then you should fill the lowest state. In this case, it's a zero state on the bottom layer. Okay, so you fill that state. But now, having filled that state, you can win a lot of exchange energy relative to all the other states by filling its isospin partner in the n equals 1 level. So one way to think about that is that its isospin partner, which was previously at rather high energy because of this orbital splitting, now gets dragged down to some relatively low energy. And depending on whether that dragging down was sufficient to overcome whatever single particle splittings there were before, you'll either populate it next or you won't. So as I've drawn it, it doesn't quite beat the other zero state, right, which was split because of this orbital symmetry breaking at the band structure level. But nevertheless, you still fill it, you'll fill the next lowest energy state. And if you were at a slightly different electric field, that competition would have come out differently. So you can build this up for every electric field. This number actually came, the number for this energy gain came from Mike's DMRG calculations, where he took into account, you know, as many of these levels, I think four of these different levels, and, you know, the finite screening from the gates and all kinds of details of the experimental system, and that turns out to actually make quite a big difference. But you can build up this whole phase diagram, so for a given electric field, you can ask which levels do I fill one at a time. And so, for example, you know, if you have to work hard. It's actually rather subtle to get something that's even qualitatively correct, but you can, in fact, build up a sort of simulated data which really constrains all of the parameters that we can constrain. And it's still, there are still things that we don't understand. In particular, the biggest unknown is what the dielectric constant, or rather what the dielectric, you know, general behavior of dielectric screening is arising from filled electron shells in the bilayer itself. One interesting fact is that, assuming a constant dielectric constant, we actually have to use a very large value, something much larger than what you'd expect from naive screening from, say, environmental dielectric. So that looks like there's lots of action from the filled Landau levels. So And again, the take-home message from this picture is that there are large regions of the parameter space where you just simply have a single component that is active. And then, of course, there are some regions where there might be dense level crossings between different states. Okay, so this is all great. We've sort of understood this isospin and orbital symmetry breaking in bilayer graphene. We understand that it's a band structure effect, but in some sense, this is all like very detailed bilayer graphene specific type of conclusion. What would be really interesting, and what was kind of the original argument for doing this measurement in the first place, is that now you have a probe of some kind of isospin, and you'd like to use that for more interesting states, in particular fractional quantum Hall states. But you'll notice that I didn't say anything about fractional quantum Hall states, and indeed, no fractional quantum Hall states are observed in any of our samples. That was until recently a kind of a problem. But fractional quantum Hall states are observed occasionally in other bilayer graphene samples, in particular in graphene on boron nitride. These were within boron nitride, but in the cleanest samples at the highest fields, a smattering of fractional quantum Hall states have been observed. There's a few thirds, there's a few couple of fifths. So you can see there at, you know, 25, 30 Tesla, you start to see some, you know, Laughlin sequence type of states. And there's one very tantalizing, very interesting observation and suspended bilayer graphene of an even denominator state at nu equals minus a half. This was by the more poor group. And of course, you know, there's the question, okay, nu equals minus a half, that's good. Is it a Pfaffian? And, you know, Dima Bonin and Zlatko Papic argued correctly, as it turns out, that that this should be indeed a Pfaffian. They did exact diagonalization calculations, and they found that, in fact, because of the fact that you have, essentially, you should be filling these states one at a time, and because this was observed at nu equals minus a half, where you'd expect to be in a half-filled one state, this should be a Pfaffian. And in fact, the obvious competitor, which, you know, because you think it's a bilayer system, maybe it should be a 3-3-1 state, turns out not really to be relevant, mostly for the reasons that I described before, that in fact this orbital symmetry breaking, or, you know, orbital degeneracy breaking, where you really only fill the zero first and then you fill the one, but you don't fill them at the same time in almost any circumstance, kind of precludes the domain where you might expect a 3-3-1 state. So that's the argument for the Pfaffian. But of course, in the experiment, it's not really clear. They didn't have multiple gates, and it's an argument. It's not it's not so direct in terms of understanding where the what orbital you're actually filling. So so for us, this was a question of you know, how to fix our samples, in a sense, right? And it's actually was maybe a bigger problem that even in the best samples reported, all of this physics was relatively weak, not that robust, hard to observe, you know, one sample out of 20, et cetera, et cetera. So we tried something, which I have to admit worked a lot better than we thought. You know, there was a, you know, one question that was unresolved was, in these graphene on boron nitride fully encapsulated devices, what's actually limiting the sample quality? So I won't walk you through how we figured this out, but it turns out that the answer is that metals are not equipotentials, and they're not that close to being equipotentials. So if you have evaporated metal films, there are grains, and within these grains there are different facets, and different facets have slightly different work functions, and even when they're tens of nanometers away, that is enough disorder to essentially wash out almost all of this physics. Luckily, we have a very simple way of getting rid of that, and that's to make devices where the metal gates are not actually made of metal, but rather they're also single crystal van der Waals materials, usually graphite for us. So, so you know, if generation one of devices has gold on top and gold on bottom, very far, you know, several, many magnetic lengths away, but nevertheless, switching to graphite devices turns out to make a very big difference, and I should give all due credit to my student, Sasha, who's the first student in my group, who put all this together and really did a pretty spectacular job. So so this is what the devices look like now. As you'll see, compared to an MBE system, what you need to make these devices is really kind of low tech, but the results are essentially comparable. So if this is what samples look like with metal gates, this is at 10 Tesla and about 50 millikelvin. These are, again, capacitance measurements, so what you're seeing are incompressible states in blue and then compressible states in yellow. And you see that there are indeed integer, you know, these are integer quantum Hall states, these blue stripes, but there's really not much. It's rather featureless at a partially filled lambda level. When you go to the graphite gates, it's extremely different. It's much richer. First of all of these integer quantum Hall states are much narrower. So if you want the localization, you know, region is very small, presumably less disorder. But more importantly, there's just a, you know, plethora. Plethora is a word you shouldn't use too much, but here really it's appropriate. There's a plethora of fractional quantum Hall states that appear. In particular, you know, throughout, you can see all of these little stripes are different fractional quantum Hall states. So we see things thirds, fifths, sevenths, ninths, elevenths, thirteenths, et cetera, almost as high as you really feel like counting. Regions where you have thirds and fifths and so on. Regions, importantly, where you have thirds and halves. So halves here, right in the region where the where Morpurgo's group observed this half, so at minus, nu equals minus a half, indeed, we have an incompressible state. And then regions where there's some very detailed interplay between different fractional quantum Hall states and different phase transitions. So you can roughly group this according to what we already know about the orbital structure. So in the n equals zero, in regions where we know we are filling an n equals zero state, we see essentially Laughlin states, thirds, fifths, sevenths, ninths, and so on, as far out as we want to count, clustered, you know, around nu equals a half. In regions where we're filling the n equals 1 states, we don't see that. We see robust thirds and we see robust half. And then we see some of the quantum Hall sequence around nu equals plus and a quarter and 3/4. But we don't see many of the other hierarchy states kind of right in the middle of the level. And then there are these regions which are marked in green here where you're in a transition between here and n equals 1 state on top layer and n equals 1 state on the bottom layer, but in between you go through all kinds of stuff, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So there are these sort of three different regimes. So this is what it looks like, for example, in the n equals 0 and 1 regimes. You see that, you know, in the n equals 0, you have this third, fifth, seventh, ninth, 11th, and so on. Same thing on the other side. You have some weak states in the nu equals a quarter composite fermion sequence, but not too many. But then in the nu equals in the n equals 1 orbitals, you have thirds, you have this quarter sequence, and then you have a robust state at nu tilde equals a half. So that nu tilde just indicates the relative filling of the Landau level. I mean, they appear at all kinds of different fillings. There's half states here, there's half states here, there's half states here, there's half states here, and they go away and come back in different places. So is it a Pfaffian? Well, you know, Zlatko and Dima argued for a Pfaffian from exact diagonalization calculations. We observe it throughout these n equals 1 single component regimes. Mike did very detailed DMRG, taking into account also everything we now know about Landau level spacing and Landau level mixing. And basically, this is the phase diagram that he calculated as a function of a parameter that essentially tells you about the Landau level form factors that depends on magnetic field, and a parameter that tells you about the Landau level mixing, which also depends on magnetic field as well as the dielectric constant. So for what we know about the dielectric constant and everything else, we think that actually the experimentally accessible regime is along this line. So as you go to higher magnetic fields, you're going actually first through a region where the Pfaffian should be more favored, and then eventually getting to maybe we can actually access a transition to a composite Fermi liquid in a single component regime, at least according to these calculations. Ask me on Friday. My students are now in Tallahassee, and they're going to try and see if they can. They have the sample in Tallahassee, and they're going to see if they can do it. Let me go quickly through this. Let me just say that the energy gaps are very large in the system. So we measure thermodynamic gaps by essentially integrating compressibility and therefore getting the change in chemical potential, and we find energy gaps on the order of 4 Kelvin. It's rather large. If you want to make an honest comparison to thermally activated gaps, you should probably multiply by the quasiparticle charge of a quarter. That's already assuming that, in fact, you know what you're looking at in some sense. But even so, the gaps are on the order of twice the size of what's observed in gallium arsenide. Could come in handy if you ever actually want to do the type of mesoscopic experiments that that people tried for a long time. And maybe more importantly, you know, we're sort of still here in terms of the experiments we've done down at up to 15 Tesla, but there's a fair amount of room for both making the field larger, which makes the Coulomb scale larger, but also potentially for finding this blue region is where the correlation length is particularly short, and presumably the Pfaffian gap is particularly large. And it's not clear actually why it's so big, whether we're just in an optimal regime of mixing, or whether in fact the system is just cleaner than even the cleanest gallium arsenide. What you mean by clean becomes a little hard. Okay, so in the last, I'll probably go 5 minutes over, but in the last 5 to 8 minutes, I'm going to tell about the tell you about these regions. I think this is the most interesting part, so I don't think you want to miss it. So let me focus on these regions where, in fact, there are level crossings between orbital states and states in different valleys. So, for example, down here, you go from a top layer polarized n equals 0, bunch of Laughlin states, to a bottom layer polarized n equals 0, bunch of Laughlin states. Here you go from a top layer polarized n equals 1 that sits on top of a filled n equals 0 in the same valley. Now you have to reverse all of that to get to this regime. So blown up, this is what that region looks like. So for example, this is, you know, old hat for gallium arsenide, but it's the first time in graphene that you see an interlayer, you know, correlated nu equals a third in the top layer, nu equals a third in the bottom layer. So this is two-thirds in the top layer, a third and a third, two-thirds in the bottom layer, and so on. That's kind of simple. That's all n equals zero physics. But then things get really hairy when you now have lots of levels involved. So you have basically four levels involved, n equals zero in each layer, n equals one in each layer at some partial fillings. And you see all kinds of fractional quantum Hall states. I'm going to zoom in and just kind of talk about this region here. And in particular, I first want to just explain what's happening. So effectively, you are starting off with, you have this full n equals zero state that's sitting underneath, full lambda level, and then you have, for example, a partially filled n equals one. So at half filling, that's what matters. You have a gap state, a charge gap state there. And then you have to reverse all of that filling, and that essentially happens by moving these levels through each other with an electric field, because they're all split up, but you can control this. So, for example, if you look at the thirds, they do a bit what you'd expect them to do. So if you think about the relative fillings of these four different levels, you start off with a fully layer polarized 1 plus a third state, and now you start to transfer occupation in lumps of a third, and you end up with a gap state where you've transferred a third of occupation to the other layer, another gap state after you transfer another third, another gap state after another third, and then finally you end up in the terminal state. Now, of course, we don't know the details of what those fractional quantum Hall wave functions actually are, but they're certainly consistent with what you might expect from kind of typical hierarchy wave functions, but that would really require some much better experiment or some numerics to really sort out what's going on. But I want to focus for the remainder of this talk on what happens at exactly nu equals a half. So thirds, fifths, sevenths, ninths, I mean, it keeps going. You have all of these kind of crossings, and that's kind of what you'd expect. But at nu equals a half, something kind of unusual happens. Sorry, so that's the transfer. Whereas at odd denominators, you have these pretty sharp phase transitions. At even denominator, it's not so sharp. So what I'm showing here is actually a very difficult measurement to make. So this is the derivative of the layer polarization with respect to the y-axis here, right? So whereas this is the derivative of the density with respect to the x-axis, that's actually really easy. That's kind of quantum capacitance, right? The derivative of the layer polarization with respect to the polarizing field is really hard to do, because that's really just measuring this tiny, tiny, very large capacitor in series with this very small capacitor. But what you can see is that as you move from the bottom towards the top, there are these kind of flares where what positive contrast here means is that now you're transferring occupation to the top, right? So, for example, at this transition at nu equals a third, you have a gap state, and then suddenly you have a big occupation transfer. That's sort of consistent with sort of a first-order type of transition, whatever you want to call it. But in the middle of the level, everything is very kind of blurry, right? And in particular, what we can do is compare what happens to the charge gap to what happens to the layer polarization, because we can quantitatively measure the change in chemical potential as we cross nu equals a half, but we can also quantitatively measure how much charge has moved from the bottom layer to the top layer as we depolarize the system. And what we find is that this charge gap that we're measuring from compressibility really persists despite a huge amount of layer depolarization. Okay, so if you think about the quantum Hall state itself, if you just dope that Pfaffian with charge, it takes very little charge before it's gone, right? But if you now are moving that charge to the other layer, it turns out that that charge gap survives for a really long time. Okay, to put some numbers on it, you can remove something like 0.17 worth of filling factor and put it onto the other layer before this charge, and the charge gap is decreasing, but it's still observable even when you've moved it quite a bit. So effectively, you've started here and you've moved almost all the way to here. It's many, many times more stable than the Pfaffian is to charge doping by itself. Okay, so in the last minute, let me tell you about kind of some theoretical ideas for what might be happening, across this phase. And this is really, I owe all credit to Mesa and Mike, who have really been extremely helpful in figuring out how to think about this. So there's really kind of four phases. We start off, we're fully polarized in the n equals 1, and we have a gap state, and we're pretty sure it's a Pfaffian because it's a single component, and if we trust numerics, then that's what it should be. At the other extreme, we fully polarize it into n equals 0, in which case you believe that it's a composite fermion liquid. Somewhere in between, we have both a mixed state that's gapped and a mixed state that's gapless. And when I say gap, I really mean charge gap. That's all we measure. Who knows what's going on in the neutral sector? And that's kind of an interesting question. So our two extremes are pretty straightforward, right? We can call it Pfaffian here. We go through a composite fermion liquid in the middle. If we now, say, take the composite fermion liquid and start to move charge out of it, that's relatively straightforward. You probably just start to make a composite fermion liquid in the other layer. Now you have a two-component composite fermion liquid, very similar to what happens in gallium arsenide at low magnetic fields, where you just have two spin species, and in fact, two Fermi surfaces have been observed in that context many years ago. But maybe the most interesting is what's happening sort of in this other phase, where you still have a charge gap, but you also have a lot of depolarization, right? So the way that we've thought about it is to think about starting with the Pfaffian and now taking electrons out of the Pfaffian and putting them, or taking whatever you take out of the Pfaffian, putting them in the other layer to make some kind of exciton. And you would expect these excitons to be strongly bound, but the big, the question that actually still shocks me is that it's not even clear what the statistics of those excitons should be. So in particular, the most naive thing would be to take an electron and put it in the other layer, and then you bind the hole to the electron, and that's essentially like the situation at nu total equals 1. You make some boson, and maybe that boson condenses, or maybe it localizes, or who knows. But apparently, according to Mike and Maysam, there's a neutral fermion in the Pfaffian also, which could potentially bind to that exciton. And as a result, you might get an exciton Fermi surface. So there's sort of two scenarios to start with where you'd say you have a neutral excitons which condense, or you might have neutral excitons which form a Fermi surface. That's quite spectacular if true, because it'd be another emergent Fermi surface from sort of, you've taken a Fermi surface, you've destroyed it with a magnetic field, you've made a Fermi surface, you've destroyed it with superconductivity, and now you make a new Fermi surface out of excitons. That's kind of remarkable if true. But of course, we don't know if the exciton Fermi surface, say, is unstable to localization of some kind or charge density wave order, or indeed superconductivity of its own. So that's where we stand right now. As far as the outlook, I think a new generation of samples really has turned out to be pretty spectacular compared to what we could do beforehand, much more spectacular than we had any right to expect. Technical advantages are that in our architecture, essentially you're guaranteed to be able to gate arbitrarily. Right? This is something that's very hard to do in gallium arsenide systems. So if you want to, for example, make interferometers, it's very difficult to do if you can't put gates nearby. Here we already have gates in a sense, so hopefully that won't be too hard to figure out. We're working now on trying to detect essentially the entropy of that comes from topological degeneracy of, say, some dilute gas of quasiparticles in the Pfaffian. You should be able to do that just from very careful measurements of temperature dependence of the chemical potential. This is a proposal of Adi Stern from some years ago. And as far as this last phase that I told you about, the numerics indicate maybe that the fermion is in fact lower energy, but who knows what other proximal phases might be there. But the good news is that in fact there should be very strong experimental signatures, particularly if we can realize things like double bilayer systems, or you could engineer this with separate contacts of the two components. Then you would expect very different, for example, counterflow or drag measurements. You might be able to detect the exciton Fermi surface if it exists. And of course, if it all turns out to be mediated by some pneumatic state, then presumably that will also be evident. So let me finish here and thank my collaborators both on the integer quantum Hall part and the fractional quantum Hall part, particularly my student and Mike and Mason from Station Q. Thank you.
Okay, so we have time for a couple of questions. Maybe we'll start with Yuna.
That's all.
So you're pretty, I'm sure you're very well aware about this observation of domain wall between AB stacking and BA stacking.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what your stacking configuration is like, and what would be the, what I understood for the first time after talking to you last time is that when you talk about these orbitals, you actually also involve the sublattice sites.
Mm-hmm.
You have A, B, and that assumes a specific stacking knowledge, whether B is at the top or A is at the top, right? So how would the possible existence of these domain walls affect your thinking And do you know whether you know your gating layer is metal or graphite? Perhaps is that also affecting that?
Yeah, so I don't think it makes a difference for the measurements that we've done because they're bulk measurements. So we have a large area sample and we measure, essentially, our signal is proportional to area. So if you have a small domain wall and there might be some interesting thing going on at the domain wall, I think that would average out compared to the area of the sample. So you'd have to have a very high density of them. I don't also think that it changes the bulk physics in the sense that if it's AB versus BA, you don't know what that is, and if you're averaging the two, they should be the same. But as far as doing things in mesoscopics, yeah, it's probably something that we'll eventually have to worry about. I'm sure it would screw things up because there'll be states of that domain wall that we don't know about.
Okay, I think there was one person there in the back, and then Mike. Maybe I'll give you. And can Max come and set up his talk while we are?
So excitons are usually bosons. So what is it? What do you mean by exciton Fermi surface?
Right. So the idea is that there's a neutral excitation of the Pfaffian. So these are excitons that you've excited by taking particles out of the Pfaffian, and it's an energetics question as to whether taking an electron in the other surface and you know whatever residual hole is in the Pfaffian and binding them is lower energy than taking those two and this neutral fermion and binding those. Which one is lower energy determines which of those neutral excitons are actually going to exist, right? So that's the exotic thing, if you want, is that binding that extra neutral fermion might actually be lower energy.
Among your many fractions, do you think any are likely to harbor Fibonacci anions? And could you measure those by this entropy technique that you mentioned?
Yes and yes. I mean, there are two fifths. Fractions in what look like n equals 1 regions. They're rather weak. And as far as I understand, that's the scenario where this is proposed. And certainly if we do this experiment, we can do it just as easily at 2/5 as we can at 1/2. It's a little bit less clear that they're there. They're not there all the time, and we don't understand exactly. They may be very sensitive to lambda level mixing, which does change in different places. But it may be. Yeah, this is also the first sample that we ever made, so it probably should get better.
Maybe last question, Duncan. No. Okay. All right. So maybe thank you, Jeff, for the interesting talks.